Hey, it's John Engle, and I'm excited to share that registration is now live for Grid Tech Connect Forum California. Join us in Newport Beach, June 24th through the 26th for the Interconnection event. We're bringing together utilities, developers, regulators, and advocates to take on one of the biggest challenges facing the energy transition, both at the DG and utility scale levels. Click the link in the episode description and use promo code PODCAST to save 10% on admission. Join our partners from the Department of Energy, NREL, Southern California Edison, PG&E, CAISO, Sunrun, NG, Convergent, AES, and so many more for this impactful event. We'll see you there. Hello and welcome to another episode of This Week in Clean Tech, a roundup of the week's biggest stories you need to know in climate and clean energy in 15 minutes or less. Today is Friday, January 26, 2024, or at least I think it is when this publishes. Maybe it's Friday, maybe it's Monday. I'm Renewable Energy World Editor-in-Chief John Engle. We'll have Matthew Daly from the Associated Press joining us shortly. But for now, I'm joined once again by Clean Tech PR veteran Mike Casey of TigerCom. Hey, Mike.
What's up, John Engle? How are you?
I'm good. We're publishing late this week or maybe early next week because I was tending to toddler all week. So that is the nature of working and also being a family man. How are you doing?
I've been there, my friend. You know, I almost sent you a clip and suggested it as a story, but I'm going to try to shoehorn it in as possibly a 6-1. It doesn't have to do with clean energy. It has to do with the landscape on which clean energy communicates. I would direct everybody's attention to a Hollywood Reporter story called "The Media is Melting Down and Neither Billionaires nor Journalists Can Seem to Stop It." It spoke to the importance, John, of what we do here. Talking to a very specific audience about the larger world. So I'll tell you, I would encourage you to take a look at it. Really interested in your thoughts. But everybody who's a communicator in clean energy, whether you're part of executive team or an in-house communicator, you need to read that story because it carries big implications for what we're doing here.
And remember to send in those story recommendations like Mike's just now, even though he didn't run that by me. I'll let it slide. You can send those to rew@clarionevents.com, and that's where you will nominate Clean Techers of the Week. And we'll have ours for this week later on in the show. All right, Mike, want to get started?
Yeah, story by Alana Samuels from Time, titled "The Rooftop Solar Industry Could Be on the Verge of Collapse." Wow, John, what'd you think?
Yeah, a lot of interesting stuff happening with residential solar right now. A tough 2023 for that segment. Yeah. The whole clean tech sector has had to deal with this inflation and high interest rate environment. And on top of that, residential solar has been met with new net metering rules in California that reduce the amount of money homes can earn from sending power to the grid. And there's the persistent problem of customer acquisition and the lengths some bad actors are going to get sales. We talked about a Time story not too long ago about the solar bro. When people go solar, they usually finance with a lease or loan rather than buying those panels up front. And there seems to be an issue where a lot of people are going solar without really understanding all those financial mechanisms. Mike, what'd you take away?
You know, my bottom line is the energy transition is multifaceted, and a critical facet is residential solar. We have got to put rooftop solar on the homes of people who want it. We need companies who will ethically do that. So I'm deeply concerned about the problems this sector is facing. Stock values are in the toilet. By the end of last year, over 100 of these companies went bankrupt, 6x-ing the prior 3 years' casualties. Growth went from 40% in 22 to 13% in 23. It's expected to be 12% this year. So some of these problems are affected by the incumbents on solar. Some are self-inflicted. All must be addressed because residential solar is too important to fail. John, story number two.
Yeah, story number two comes from the Wall Street Journal, written by Benoit Morin and Jennifer Hiller, titled "U.S. Oil Drillers Are Going Electric If They Can Get the Electricity." Mike, what'd you think?
I want to remind our audience, the U.S. is the world's largest oil and gas producer right now. In fact, we're the largest in human history. So until I read this piece, I didn't appreciate how much electricity was required for that activity. In Martin County, Texas, population 5,000, frackers daily use energy the equivalent of four cities of Seattle. So that's a lot. At the same time, these oil drillers are being pressured to lower their carbon pollution footprint. So they started sourcing electricity from wind and solar, which is really interesting, rather than from gas-fired generators. I think that's what we'd call progress, not perfection. So an IEA report found that using electricity instead of diesel or natural gas here could cut 350 million metric tons of carbon pollution by 2030. That's more pollution than most U.S. states pollute in an entire year. So the grid's struggling to handle this new demand. So companies that can't wait for that infrastructure are constructing their own substations and microgrids, which is really interesting. John, what do you think?
Yeah, there's a whole new market for C&I digital substations, which is really interesting dynamic. And this behind-the-meter utility-scale solar and wind that we're starting to see pop up in those locations around manufacturing facilities, I think, is fascinating. Electricity sales increased over the past decade in states with major oil and gas fields, largely because of the Permian oil patch and the growth of Bitcoin miners and data centers. In North Dakota, where sales rose over 58% overall and 120% for industrial customers, discussions about improving the power grid to support pollution reduction in fracking have already started to take shape. All right, Mike, what's our third story?
Will Wade with Bloomberg, a story called China Leads Global Clean Energy Spending, which record $1.8 trillion in 2023. John?
Yeah, here's the top line. Global clean energy spending increased 17% last year to $1.8 trillion. But according to Bloomberg NEF, we need to be investing 170% more in clean technology to reach net zero by 2050. China spent $676 billion last year, a 6% increase, while the US, UK, and Europe saw a combined investment of $718 billion, driven by IRA incentives, strong EV sales in the UK, and growing demand for renewables across Europe. Mike, what'd you take away?
Well, so I don't ever want to hear again from the ideology over reality crowd that China builds all these coal plants. Look, it was always a dumb argument. Second, those who drank that grain alcohol were just helping distract our country from the reality that China is on a decades-long drive to be the global leader in clean energy. We can either let them take that from us because we invented all this stuff, or we can wake up and compete here. The EV sector had the largest investments, with global spending climbing 36% to $634 billion. It surpasses renewable energy, which increased 8% to $623 billion. And although we're increasing clean energy spending, boy, we've got to be doing a lot more to reach net zero pollution. John, our fourth story.
Yeah, fourth one comes from Katie Brigham from Heatmap, titled "The Coolest Thing in Climate Tech is a Super Hot Rock." Mike?
Yeah, disclosure first, this is a story that references one of our clients, Rondo Energy. But I think this is a really important thing because I did not know this until I started working in this space, that a quarter of global carbon pollution comes from heavy industry. And that's in part because it just demands a lot of heat and industrial steam at very high temperatures. So you burn a lot of fossil fuels to create that. And traditionally, these industries have been seen as very hard to clean up. But what we're finding is some of the simplest technologies that are already on hand are some of the fastest ways to clean this up. It's almost like Occam's razor, I think, in terms of a solution. John, what do you think?
Yeah, this whole idea wouldn't have been possible if solar and wind prices hadn't declined as much as they have over the last 10 years. But now, as we keep adding more to the grid, energy at certain times of the day is increasingly curtailed. It goes to waste. So it makes sense someone would want to come in and take advantage of that oversupply. We've talked about green hydrogen as a solution for fueling, especially heavy industry, and it can get higher temperatures than thermal batteries for making things like steel. But at low temperatures, thermal batteries are more efficient. Green hydrogen requires almost twice as much electricity as an input for the given amount of heat. And one advantage of this space is that it relies on cheap materials that are already made at scale. So Rondo is using bricks, and they have plans with a manufacturer to reach 90 gigawatt hours of storage per year. That'd be more than any battery manufacturing plant on earth. All right, Mike, let's get to our last one and our guest this week.
Yeah, Matthew Daly's going to join us here from Associated Press. His story is "Liquefied Natural Gas, What to Know About LNG and Biden's Decision to Delay Gas Export Proposals." I think this is a really big deal for clean energy. And Matthew, thanks for joining us. If for people who haven't read the piece, what's the biggest takeaway you'd like them to have right now?
Well, I think it's more of a political decision than it is, and frankly, an economic decision, because it does not affect current LNG projects. We are, as you mentioned, we're the largest oil producer. We're also the largest LNG exporter. And we just have doubled our LNG exports in the last few years, and we're projected to double them again by 2027. And so what this does is pause future projects or consideration of future projects. It's sort of a attempt by Biden, I think, to basically placate the climate activists who have really been pushing him ever since he approved the huge Willow oil project in Alaska.
Matthew, the discourse was hot when this announcement came out over whether this is a climate positive move or maybe even negative, given that you think that U.S. LNG is displacing potentially dirtier sources in emerging markets and overseas. Have you been able to narrow down what the factual evidence is around the climate implications? Because to your point, it does feel just very political in this immediate aftermath.
Yeah, I think it still remains to be seen. I mean, what the argument that is that it's could be bad for the environment is that it will end up being replaced by coal produced elsewhere. The argument against that argument is that LNG itself is very heavily energy intensive. You've got to frack it, first of all, then you've got to super chill it to unbelievably low temperatures to turn it into liquid. Then you put it on ships and you go all the way to Europe or to Asia. Then you reheat it and you send it back out to Europe or Asia. That's a big, use of energy in itself. And so there's a whole argument that along the way, you've got methane leaks and other problems. So I don't know if any definitive study is out there, but it's certainly an argument can be made that it is a very energy intensive process.
Matthew, someone once said to me that the construction of all these LNG export terminals was really the migration of the U.S. gas industry from a domestic industry to an international industry. How far along on that trajectory do you think we are right now as Biden hits the pause button, however temporarily, on the growth of this sector?
Yeah, I think that's a good observation. I think we're pretty far along the way. I mean, I remember covering this 10 years ago, and the idea was, are we going to have exports, or how is that going to work? Originally, when some of these export terminals were proposed, they were actually proposed as import terminals. So the whole world has kind of flipped in the last 10 years, and the growth has been explosive in terms of the LNG, how we produce it and how it's used. I mean, it's a political game now, because the way it's being portrayed is that we're sort of the savior for Europe from Russia, and that Russian gas would be used if we didn't send it. But there's an argument to be made that maybe they wouldn't need as much because renewables are increasing in Europe. And Europe is actually not criticizing this decision the way industry here is or Republican politicians.
How is industry responding, Matthew? Because I see the headlines this week saying demand remains very high for American LNG, and that business has been quite good over, the decade. So does that side of the fence see this as a momentary pause, a political maneuver? We'll wait until someone else comes into office and, switches lanes, and we'll just kind of weather the storm until then? Because it seems political, it seems temporary, potentially, and more of a long-term promise of the impacts. Am I getting
I think
that
that's
right?
Exactly right. And usually in these situations, the industry has a little bit sort of more tempered reaction than the politicians. You can always count on the politicians to just say, this is an outrage, this is the worst thing ever. And usually industry doesn't go quite that far. I've been a little surprised by the, as you said, they came in hot. The rhetoric has been hot from industry about being betrayed by Biden and that he's kind of going against his own policies about cleaner energy, because there is this belief in the industry that natural gas is much, much cleaner than coal, which it is. But there's a whole belief on the other side, from the climate activist side, is if you really want to address climate change, you've got to get rid of all fossil fuels. And natural gas is a fossil fuel, and methane, particularly in the short term, is a leading cause of climate change.
Matthew, last question on this, but I wrote last year a question on LinkedIn. Can anybody name any elected official anywhere in America who's actually afraid of politically crossing either the climate activist movement or the climate solutions industry. And it was pretty much crickets. Like no one could name anybody. But what the reason I said I thought this was a big deal is not because of its impact on anybody's bottom line, but because I think this is a sign that actually the Biden campaign is a little politically afraid of crossing climate activists because climate activism has grown so much in the ranks of youth voters. Do you think there's any merit to that? And you're not going to hurt my feelings if you tell me I'm totally wrong here.
No, I think that is right. I was going to say the word I was listening for was youth activists, that basically the climate activism and the youth vote is really where he's intersecting here. Because they're also disenchanted with Israel and Gaza. There's a whole other issue that we don't want to get into on a climate story, but there are some issues with youth voters. And I think the Willow thing really took them by surprise because the TikTok videos, the Instagram videos, they were huge and they got the word Willow known. It's like Keystone. There's not that many projects that are known by their one name. And they tried to make that happen with CP2, which was the major LNG project down in Louisiana. That didn't really happen. But the idea of LNG exports, that is a little bit broken through. I would say a little bit less so maybe than Willow. So perhaps they're overstating this. I don't know that this is going to make every young person in America want to vote for Joe Biden.
Well, John, we're just about out of time. I think we've got to get to our clean ticker of the week.
Yeah, Jimmy Rogers, manager of communications at Redaptive, was nominated by Jim Benson, saying he's passionate about Redaptive's vision to accelerate the world's transformation toward a sustainable future. So congratulations to Jimmy.
All right, and we're about out of time, so I'm going to thank our wonderful producer, Brian Mendez, Claire the Factor Quirin, Alex Style Guy Peterson for helping us gather these stories up, and Matthew Daly for coming on the show. John, it is good to see you again, and I will see you next week. We've actually got a live show coming up later this month.
That's right. We'll be at DistribuTech International, so check us out on the website for scheduling and all that kind of stuff. But we will be doing This Week in Cleantech from that exhibit hall floor, so looking forward to it. Matthew, Mike, thank you so much.
Thank you.
See you in a week. Take care.
Hey, it's John Engel, and I'm excited to share that registration is now live for Grid Tech Connect Forum California. Join us in Newport Beach, June 24th through the 26th for the Interconnection event. We're bringing together utilities, developers, regulators, and advocates to take on one of the biggest challenges facing the energy transition, both at the DG and utility scale levels. Click the link in the episode description and use promo code PODCAST to save 10% on admission. Join our partners from the Department of Energy, NREL, Southern California Edison, PG&E, CAISO, Sunrun, NG, Convergent, AES, and so many more for this impactful event. We'll see you there.